Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Good morning, I'm Taylor Wilson, and this is 5 Things You Need to Know Saturday, the 11th of September, 2021. Today, 20 years since 9/11. What happened, and where are we now? Here are some of the top headlines. The U.S. has now spent nearly $12 billion on care and compensation for people exposed to dust on 9/11. And more than 100,000 people are enrolled in the World Trade Center Health Program, which gives free care to people with health problems possibly linked to the dust. And more than 4,000 of them have some kind of chronic pulmonary disease. France has joined other European countries in requiring vaccinations for American visitors. The EU removed the U.S. from its safe travel list on August 30th, pointing to rising COVID-19 cases. And the U.S. has stopped all U.S.-bound flights of Afghan refugees from 2 bases in Germany and Qatar. The reason, a limited measles outbreak among some Afghans arriving in the United States. It's been 20 years since the September 11th terror attacks.
I'm sitting out front, and this plane, I'm telling you, it's so low, it's the second time it came around. I really ain't expecting it to land in the water. I mean, it's that low. I look, I can see the Bay on Bridge from my front door, and there's a fighter jet escorting it. But the second time, I have to tell you, it looked pretty low. I mean, it's banking really steeply, so I don't know what's going on with it, but I'm not one to make phone calls like this, but I was wondering if there's something wrong with it.
911
operator 131,
what is your emergency?
I'm in Jersey City, New Jersey, and we want to know what's going on because there's like planes, look, they're going inside the buildings, everybody's outside going crazy.
There's what?
It looks like planes are going, they're trying to go in the building, everybody's outside going crazy.
What's trying to go in the building?
It didn't sound like a plane was trying to go into one of the buildings.
A plane?
Yeah, but they don't know if it's federal practices they do in the air, but we're all outside by the Hudson, and we don't know what's going on here. There's no cops. Nobody's telling us anything.
Hijacked planes crashed into the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center in New York, the Pentagon in Washington, and a field in Pennsylvania.
The cockpit's not answering. Somebody stabbed in business class. And I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
That was flight attendant Betty Ong on the first plane, American Airlines Flight 11, which hijackers minutes later flew into the North Tower. The building, along with its twin South Tower, collapsed that morning. Later, another plane hit the Pentagon, and yet another, likely headed for the U.S. Capitol, crashed in Stony Creek Township, Pennsylvania, after passengers fought back against the hijackers. Nearly 3,000 people were killed, the majority in the Twin Towers, where more than 2,700 people died. Some were killed instantly when the planes hit the buildings. Some were above the impact zones and could not get down to evacuate, dying when the buildings collapsed or beforehand from smoke inhalation or burns. Others fell or jumped to their deaths. But there were stories of miraculous survival. 20 people survived the collapse itself, 14 of them in a stairwell in the middle of the North Tower. Pasquale Bazzelli survived after staying at his North Tower 64th floor Port Authority office even after the South Tower collapsed, which he and his co-workers did not know from their side of the building. Fire safety officials told him and his colleagues to stay put. Many of them were in the building when terrorists set off a bomb in the underground garage in 1993, and they remembered the inside of the towers was the safest place to be. The North Tower's public address system was also not working due to the plane crash. Bozzelli and co-workers were later on the stairwell at around the 22nd or 13th floor, based on different survival accounts, when the building came down. He woke up 3 hours later on a pile of rubble. Many of the victims who died have never been formally identified. But just this week, days before today's anniversary, the New York City chief medical examiner identified two more victims through DNA analysis. They are the first victims to be identified since 2019. But 60% of the attack's victims have still not been identified. This week, people around the country have been marking the somber anniversary. The New York Stock Exchange held a minute of silence yesterday, and President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden will visit all three sites where the attacks unfolded. 9/11 was also a day that journalists who covered it will never forget. It was reported in real time on radio and television, and the next day's newspapers were filled with on-the-ground reports and photos bringing the horror to Americans around the country and people all over the world. One photo quickly became one of the most recognizable in American history. It shows three firefighters raising an American flag with Ground Zero in the background. The picture was taken by the Bergen Records' Tom Franklin.
I went to Exchange Place in Jersey City, which is where I made pictures throughout the morning that day. There was a police official of some sort, I don't know if he was a captain or a chief, and he said, wait right here, I'll see what I can do. And then in a very short amount of time, he came back to us and he said, hey, you can get on this boat right here. At this point, both towers had collapsed, and I was still unaware of how many people died, what was the cause of this, disaster. I didn't have a lot of the information that people who were watching on TV had. We had very limited cell service. There were no smartphones back then. Whoever was in charge of that boat, it was the tugboat captain, I believe. He handed me an N95 mask and a bottle of water and basically said, be careful. And I walked all around the wreckage and was making pictures of people, first responders searching for survivors. There was just an incomprehensible amount of debris and wreckage. It really was like a war zone. Almost 5 o'clock. And at that point, I had saw these three firemen on a little bit of a rise, fumbling with a flag. And it didn't immediately register to me what they were about to do, but it seemed significant. So I moved into a position where I could observe what they were doing. And then I could tell that they were transferring a flag from one pole to another. And very quickly, they hoisted the flag up a pole. And I shot a burst of photographs. And it looked good, but it didn't really stand out in any way to me compared to all that I had photographed at that point. The flag raising was one of the last pictures I made. So it was one of the last pictures I edited and transmitted. And by the time I had gotten to it, I recognized that it was symbolic and I recognized that, it was kind of a special thing. But it didn't really register with me until I had transmitted it and Rich Geely, the photo editor, called me. And he's like, you got to tell me more about this picture. This is really something special. Was the flag going up? Was it coming down? Did you get their names? Did you talk to them? And I really didn't have any of those pieces of information. This photograph was the viral photograph before there were viral photographs. It was breathtaking to think about how, people were really trying to leverage this image in a commercial way. I think it's important to note that the record immediately set up a foundation, which I was a part of, within hours of the picture being published. And we decided that the money that the photograph would generate would be used for charity. And so I think that was something that was very commendable of the record and the Borgs. The photograph is really about one thing for me. It's a symbol of three firemen raising a flag in an act of solidarity and unity in the wake of the most horrible attack and tragedy in our country's history.
For those who lost loved ones 20 years ago, many say they don't need a special milestone to stop and mourn. For them, never forget is all too real. That's the case for Christopher Deloche. He lost his wife, Port Authority Police Captain Kathy Mazza, that day. She was in the lobby of the North Tower helping people evacuate when the building collapsed. She was the first female Port Authority police officer killed in the line of duty. Christopher said, it doesn't get easier.
The anniversary, it's, I know that's how we mark things, but it doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't make it any harder because we lived through the worst part of it, which was when it happened. Like I said, you learn to live with it. You never forget it. I mean, there'll be days when it's just as bad as that exact day. But, you know, you take out the good. That's what I've learned to do. You know, and I've done that with a lot of people who've passed in my life. I take out all the good memories.
The 9/11 attacks were carried out by the Islamic terrorist group Al-Qaeda. And almost immediately after, many Muslim Americans were targeted with fear, suspicion, harassment, and violence. Filmmaker Aman Ali told the USA Today Network about instant Islamophobia he experienced.
I was just like, please don't let it be Muslim. Like, please don't let it be Muslim. Like, please don't let it, any Middle Eastern name or anything. Like, because I can just imagine what kind of hysteria and fear that would cause. Like, I already anticipated, you know, that potential backlash. And at that point, still don't fully know what had happened. But a kid stood up in class and there were rumblings about this being the Taliban or this group or Al-Qaeda or this or that. And he stood up and he said, I hope we should bomb Afghanistan until it glows. Like, let's, you know, blow it up to smithereens, like nuclear bombs, whatever. And I said, well, and I confronted him and I said, well, yes, let's go after who did this, but why should we bomb an entire country, any country, for what a group of people did? And he said, well, oh, don't tell me you're like, oh, are you supporting that? And I said, no, I'm not supporting them. I'm just saying, let's go after who did it. Why take out innocent civilians? I'll never forget this. Like, he goes, I bet it was probably your dad flying that plane, wasn't it? And the teacher had just stepped out of the room when he said this, and room got quiet, and I grabbed him by his shirt, and I was getting ready to punch him for him saying something like that, and he had this look on his face, like a smile, like a smirk, almost like I knew it. And that smile has haunted me to this day. This was maybe like a week after 9/11, and I'm outside and I'm walking down the street to a friend's house, and a guy in a pickup truck drives by and yells, "Go back to where you came from." And I said, I live three houses down. Should I go home? Should I go home? And he goes, yeah, F you. And he just drives off. I'm like, what? And so, but I think early on, I started seeing the absurdity of this level of ignorance. That, yes, I was initially scared, but I also realized how absurd some of these things were. And again, I'm not making fun of it, but like, people being attacked for like no reason, like the Sikh community and the Hindu community, like people that had literally nothing to do with it. And I just said, there is just, people are just using this as an excuse to hate people and just trying to normalize hate. And people think this was 9/11 that created hate. I said, no, this is, people are just using this as a front to fuel their feelings of white supremacy.
In the two decades since, some Muslim Americans have found ways to push back against that Islamophobia. They include Shukri Olol, who's running for county council in Washington state.
As a candidate, especially who is visibly Muslim, in front of cameras, right, that I have to be cautious about kind of how I conduct myself, because I know that for some people, it'll be the first time that they meet a Muslim or engage with a Muslim. And I want to make sure that they know that, you know, whatever stereotype or image that they had is not the reality. I think it is actually one of the reasons why I'm running for office, this feeling of being othered and feeling like I don't belong here. And pushing against that rhetoric and saying that this is also my home. This is the country where I've been the longest, almost 23 years now. And wanting to create an environment where, regardless of what other people do, that we know that we belong here, that we are safe here.
And Isak Patan, the Bay Area director for the Islamic Networks Group. According to its website, the organization focuses on peace building and face-to-face education to grow understanding of Muslims and other misunderstood groups.
I was really interested in working with the Muslim community in some way. And I think I had several experiences growing up that led me to want to continue to like move in this direction. It would have made such a difference if I was a confident young boy in terms of, you know, how I would have strategized my entire life, I think. But from always coming from a place of, you know, people maybe not like people ask my identity, I think that I never hid my identity, but I was aware of that context. And I think that hinders, you know, certain levels of growth that could be there.
The sense among Americans that September 11, 2001 permanently changed life in the U.S. has grown, not faded, 20 years later. In a USA Today Suffolk University poll last month, by a margin of 60% to 38%, most Americans say 9/11 changed Americans' lives forever. That 22-point margin is a bigger majority than the 9-point margin at 54 to 45% in a USA Today Gallup poll on the first anniversary in 2002, and the 17-point margin, 58 to 41%, on the 10th anniversary in 2011. And people who were the youngest during the attacks, or even not born yet, say they felt the change most strongly. At 72 to 26%, people under the age of 35 see permanent changes, compared with a ratio of 52 to 46% for people aged 65 and up. For more anniversary coverage, head to usatoday.com. You can also find great local stories, like some you heard in today's show, by checking out USA Today Network publications all around the country, like more on the Bergen Records coverage that day and in the weeks after, or the Detroit Free Press, which asked Metro Detroit Muslims, the largest Muslim community in the country, to reflect on the 20 years since 9/11. Also, we didn't touch much on the war on terror in today's pod, which came out of 9/11. But you can hear more on the war in Afghanistan specifically in recent episodes of Five Things, including our August 31st episode in particular. And on tomorrow's Five Things, hear how a generation with no memory of 9/11 has come to understand it and its aftermath. You'll hear from Gen Zers sharing how Islamophobia, the war in Afghanistan, and the attack itself have impacted their lives. That's hosted by Shannon Green, and you can find it right here on this feed. Thanks to Shannon and Claire Thornton, as always, for their great work on the show. And do us a favor and subscribe or follow wherever you're listening. Five Things is part of the USA Today Network.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.